It hasn't been a great week for Arizona Attorney General Tom Horn. He's facing allegations over this year's campaign and those from 2010. This week, the Yavapai County Attorney overruled a judge's decision, and Horn's not happy about it.
For her to say, well, I'm going to ignore what the judge says, I'm not going to give respect to a neutral judicial officer, it'd be like a base runner getting called out at base and saying, well, I overruled the umpire and I say that I'm safe.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Today on the show, the politics. Also, how do you reduce the number of teens not in school and not working? A walk-off for an ASU sporting landmark.
And one of Phoenix's oldest neighborhoods is ready for its close-up.
I think the pictures, it shows how close everybody is and how when you live together and you've been here for years, you help each other and see more each other as family, not just as that's my neighbor.
Plus, Shakespeare among the saguaros and a segment in the form of a question.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. The weekend has started early when it comes to heat, looking for a high temperature today of 104, and then for this weekend, highs of 104 and 102. Already here at 204, it's 101 degrees under sunny skies at KJZZ.
It hasn't been a good day for drivers using Interstate 17. As KJZZ's Peter O'Dowd reports, two serious crashes have caused long delays.
Early Friday morning on a section of southbound 17, three people died when a driver traveling the wrong direction collided with a minivan. That crash happened about 30 miles north of Phoenix. Three people in the minivan were killed. A young boy in that minivan was also seriously injured. So was the wrong-way driver. DPS says the suspect, a man in his 60s, was likely impaired. A second crash later in the day involved a motorcycle traveling northbound. ADOT says anyone going north from Phoenix will face significant backups this afternoon. Authorities had to shut down traffic to one lane for a 9-mile stretch north of New River. Peter O'Dowd, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Approximately the same number of Arizonans is expected to travel over Memorial Day this year as last. AAA Arizona says more than 718,000 Arizonans will travel. That's a 1% increase over last year. The vast majority of travelers will hit the road. Those who fly will see slightly higher airfares than in 2013. AAA says Southern California is one of the top travel destinations for Arizona. Following up on Peter O'Dowd's story, we'll just check Valley traffic as well. There's an accident on the 101 southbound in Scottsdale at Princess Drive.
It's probably not a stretch to say Arizona Attorney General Tom Horn has had better weeks in his life. On Monday, a former employee, Sarah Beatty, filed an affidavit claiming she spent the majority of her time in the AG's office doing campaign work on Horn's behalf. Beatty's attorney is Tom Ryan.
The plain fact of the matter is Tom Horn and the executive office is doing a substantial amount of campaigning on taxpayer money, and it is unfair to the process.
Then on Wednesday, Yavapai County Attorney Sheila Polk decided to overrule an administrative law judge's finding that Horn and an aide did not illegally coordinate on an independent expenditure committee during the 2010 election. Polk ordered Horn and aide Kathleen Wynn to repay donors $400,000 plus fines.
But Horn maintains his innocence on both counts and says his office is careful about how and when campaign work is done.
We are very strict that anybody here who chooses to volunteer for my campaign, which is their First Amendment right, they must go off-site to do any campaign work. The lady who made the charge has a record of attacking every employer practically that she's ever worked for. She's only 25, but she's already has quite a record on that.
It sounds like your strategy here is kind of, it almost sounds like you're trying to reduce her credibility on this.
Obviously, she's made a charge that isn't true, so it's obviously relevant that she doesn't have any credibility because whenever she leaves an employer, she does the same thing.
Two county prosecutors have found problems with the original campaign finance case, and you've said all along that there's no merit to it. So I'm curious what those prosecutors and some of the other people who have raised concerns, what do they have to gain by going after you if there's not anything there?
Well, Mark, I'm really glad you asked that question because I'm profoundly shocked that Sheila Polk refused to respect the decision of a neutral administrative law judge. This was the first time these allegations were presented to someone neutral to consider the evidence, and the administrative law judge ruled in my favor and found that there had been no coordination. It was a false charge. It got a tremendous amount of publicity. I was hit with repeated headlines, some of which were of the size that you'd expect if the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, and they were all false charges. It was a real smear job. And this neutral judge said, there's nothing to it. It's not true. And now Sheila Polk says, well, I lost this case, so I get to overrule the judge, which is horrendous. It'll be reversed in court for sure.
But that is part of state law, right? She does have the right to overrule the administrative law judge.
Well, it's a law that was developed for specialized agencies like the Registrar of Contractors or the Environmental Protection Agency, where there's a certain amount of deference paid to their expertise. She has no expertise, certainly not in election law. And for her to be my adversary and to lose and to have the neutral judge rule in my favor, and then for her to say, well, I'm going to ignore what the judge says, I'm not going to give respect to a neutral judicial officer, it'd be like a base runner getting called out at base and saying, well, I overruled the umpire and I say that I'm safe.
But what does she gain from continuing this case?
She was my adversary, and she lost, and she didn't like losing, so she's refusing to accept the decision. It'll be imposed on her because the Superior Court clearly will support the neutral administrative law judge.
Given the fact that it seems like so many of the issues with which you've been dealing over the last year or so have been campaign-related, it seems like your office could be maybe a little more careful about saying, hey, look, maybe don't do it on your work time. Maybe do it at night once you've left the office, once you're home, and don't have anything to do with this office.
Yeah, I think we do make that clear. And, you know, you're making an interesting point about what's been covered, because in the meantime, I've dismantled 15 drug cartels. I've greatly increased our consumer protection. I've brought $2 billion into the state to help keep people in their homes, and which also helps the economy of the state. I've had for 3 years going an important task force to fight child sex trafficking. But unfortunately, what the media seems to want to do is engage in personal attacks. And it'd be nice if they would start to cover the real issues.
Well, I mean, you talk about personal attacks, but I'm not sure that anybody is necessarily going after Tom Horn, the person. They're going after Tom Horn, the candidate, right?
I know, but it'd be nice if they would report what I've achieved as Attorney General.
Do you think ultimately that these issues will affect the outcome of the primary, or if you win the primary, will affect you in the general?
I think I'm going to win both elections. The primary shows me way ahead. The last poll that I showed with respect to the general showed me 4 points ahead, which is about exactly the same as I beat the Democrat in 2010.
Arizona Attorney General Tom Horn.
Arizona Republic columnist Bob Robb says Horn may be fooling himself, but he has clearly dug in his heels for a nasty fight.
I think he feels like a caged animal politically, and that this is the only way he can try to fight himself out. I don't know that it's a successful strategy. An awful lot of the people that he turned on are people whom he initially chose. Sheila Pope, for example, was the county attorney to whom Tom Horn referred this matter.
Has he lost perspective from this standpoint, that when all these things are piled up, and you mentioned being a caged animal, can he really think he hasn't done anything wrong and everyone is just sort of piling on against him?
I have difficulty psychoanalyzing Tom Horn and understanding what makes him tick and do some of the things that he does. He clearly thinks that he can get away with it, but whether he in his own mind feels as though he's done nothing wrong or whether he's just kind of a slippery character who can rationalize his behavior from moment to moment and convincing himself that he's always stayed on the right side of a elusive line, I just don't know.
Are there enough people who either will just throw up their hands if Horn were to win the Republican primary and Rotolini wins by default? Or are there enough people who would switch to her based on their sort of just being tired of Horn at this point?
I don't think we can write the end of that political script yet. Certainly you have to say that Horn is extremely damaged in a Republican primary and probably even more damaged in a general election. If Tom Horn survives the Republican primary, he will be easily the most vulnerable Republican on a statewide ticket.
Bob Robb of the Arizona Republic. The Valley has a problem with the number of kids who are neither in school nor working. The region has among the highest percentages in the country of so-called disconnected youth between the ages of 16 and 24.
Kristen Lewis is co-director of Measure of America, which is a project of the Social Science Research Council and has written on this subject. Last fall, her research ranked Phoenix fourth among major metro areas in terms of the most disconnected kids. 2 years ago, Phoenix was the worst. Lewis says this isn't a new phenomenon nationally.
for decades there have been some kids who are disconnected, but there was a real surge in youth disconnection after the Great Recession. So prior to the recession, about 5 million young people ages 16 to 24 were not working or in school. But after the Great Recession, by the end of the Great Recession, that figure had surged to 5.8 million young people. And that figure has not really budged.
So in reading your report, it looks like the Phoenix area has gotten better over the last year or so, but still not great.
Right. So when we did this analysis a couple years back, Phoenix had the highest youth disconnection rate among the 25 largest metro areas. It was 18.8 at that time. And the rate now has indeed gone down a bit. So now it's 17.2. Still in the bottom five, unfortunately.
What were the other cities in the bottom with Phoenix?
So at the top of the list in terms of low levels of youth disconnection are Boston, Minneapolis, Washington, D.C., San Diego, and San Francisco. The bottom five are Portland, Phoenix, Charlotte, Detroit, and Riverside, San Bernardino.
Are there any traits that, looking at those five cities in the bottom, that they all seem to share, or attributes that seem to have them in common?
Well, we found a few things related to neighborhood conditions that I think are really important to keep in mind. Basically, disconnected young people tend to come from neighborhoods where adults are also, in a sense, disconnected. We also found that the sharp inequalities among neighborhoods and cities are really nothing new. The rate of youth disconnection by neighborhood in 2000 is highly predictive of the rate of youth disconnection in the same neighborhoods in 2010, 2011.
So what do we do about this? How do we fix it?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I wish there were a super easy answer. But so I would say three things. First, we can't give up on the kids who are disengaged today. But a much more effective strategy over the long term is preventing youth disconnection. So keeping kids from dropping out of school and dropping out of mainstream society is easier than kind of luring them back in. Another important thing is that although some study beyond high school is really critical for success and economic security these days, the whole sort of college for all idea is kind of blocking out meaningful alternatives for some young adults and sending a message that anything but a four-year bachelor's degree is somehow second best. And last but not least, setting meaningful targets is really, really important. So setting a target to reduce youth disconnection in Phoenix from 17.2% to, say, 14 or 15%, which is the national average, you know, that would be a really good goal. Cutting in half the gaps between different groups or different places would also be a great goal.
Kristen Lewis is co-director of Measure of America in New York. With the Valley's ranking, groups here have been trying to reduce the percentage of disconnected kids. One of them is the Helios Education Foundation, which has helped give mayors statewide a forum to talk about the issue. Barbara Ryan Thompson is Helios's chief operating officer and says a key goal is to get kids who have disconnected to re-engage.
I think education is at the heart of it. I mean, in terms of making sure that students stay engaged or get re-engaged. There's so many factors that lead to disengagement, I think. It could be family situation, you know, what goes on from the time students leave the school building. But also, I think there are probably many students who don't see where the education is going to take them, and they feel they start to disconnect. So I think education is a key point. But when you're looking at disconnected youth, or what we've sort of, through some of our other work, have started referring to these youth as opportunity youth, because they are a huge opportunity for us. Yeah, there are other factors that, you know, the juvenile justice system, higher education, other social services, all of those are parties and actors that really need to be engaged in the discussion around opportunity youth and how to re-engage them.
So is the goal then to show some of these kids that, yes, it makes sense to go back to school or to try to maybe get a technical degree or something, because you can get a job, you can maybe get a better job than what you'd be able to do without?
Absolutely, yeah. I think there's, throughout the country, and I think there's some efforts here in Arizona to really look at ways to re-engage these students, to really get them back on a path to school and education, whatever that means for them and whatever is most appropriate for them, but leading them on to really a livable career.
That kind of sounds like a tough sell.
I think it is. You know, I think it requires a lot of parties, I think.
How optimistic are you that we'll be able to get this thing turned around?
You know, I we're doing a lot of work at Helios across the education continuum in terms of really trying to prevent students from disconnecting. So, you know, we know there are so many really important points across the education continuum, reading at grade level by the end of third grade, which is a big focus for us, and actually helping, working with schools to make sure that we're creating engaging programs and ensuring that students graduate from high school, college, and career ready and are able to move on to get a post-secondary degree or certificate. So I think, and I think there's a lot of effort and focus on that. I think we're seeing that we've got a real concern around the sort of the educational outcomes for our students to begin with. And I hope that will help students from disengaging along the way.
Barbara Ryan Thompson is the Chief Operating Officer of the Helios Education Foundation.
The 1-1 pitch to Bond, a towering fly ball to center. Back goes Grissom to the wall, gone. Number 72.
And Pedroia hits one high and deep to left field. Cespedes going back at the wall. La Luna, grand slam style.
Bob Horner has become the 11th player in baseball history to hit four homers in one game.
A few of the all-time stars from the Arizona State University baseball program. Bob Horner, Dustin Pedroia, and Barry Bonds. Packard Stadium, where the three and many others made their marks since the park was built in 1974, is hosting its final Pac-12 series this weekend as ASU next year moves to Phoenix Municipal Stadium. Jeff Metcalf has covered the program for more than two decades for the Arizona Republic.
If you go back to 74, Fred Miller was the young athletic director here then, and they had just that, for that graduation of 74, they had opened the Activity Center, which is now Wells Fargo Arena, but they had still not played a basketball game yet. The rest of their athletic complex basically didn't exist other than Sun Devil Stadium, which had been built in 59. Packard really drove the private donations that helped Fred to get a tennis stadium, to get a track stadium. This was kind of the trigger of all that, because at that point when the Packard brothers, Guthrie and Peter, donated the money, that was the largest private gift that had ever been given at the time at ASU.
What's unique about Packard Stadium itself? I mean, does it play differently? Is there something about the wind? Is there anything that really stands out?
It's a fast stadium. It's relatively small, so it's sort of an offensive-oriented stadium. ASU doesn't necessarily have a big hitting team this year, but over the years they have had a lot of teams. I mean, I feel sorry for the cars going by in Rural Road because they're kind of a target. When ASU leaves here, it'll be a much safer passageway on Rural Road.
Have you talked to any of the fans about, maybe some of those who've been season ticket holders for 30 to 40 years, are they going to miss this place? And if they are they going to miss it in the sense that we all miss things nostalgically, or are they going to miss it in terms of, boy, this was really a great place to see a game?
I think the hardest thing for the fans is that you're leaving campus. This facility, if they rebuilt this facility, if they had the money to do that, I think that would be the preferable path that the fans would vote for. But you're talking about $225 or more million to redo Sun Devil Stadium. And realistically, trying to put $20 to $30 million to redo this probably isn't the most cost-effective way of doing it.
Jeff Metcalf of the Arizona Republic.
Still to come, Shakespeare goes outside this weekend at the Desert Botanical Gardens.
I think, even if there are certain things, you know, the weather or whatever, they kind of get swept up in the magic of being outside that you really don't get anywhere else.
We'll visit Fairy Worlds later. It's the show.
Good afternoon. With Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. Quick check of Valley traffic. An accident, I-10 westbound at 16th Street. And the forecasters were right. It is very hot around the valley right now. Currently 101 degrees, looking for a high today of 104, and pretty similar for the rest of the weekend.
What is the show, you ask? It's a KJZZ original production that mixes news and features from the valley, the region, and national and even international news to provide a stream of engaging radio.
KJZZ is supported by Gateway Airport in Mesa, with summer getaways to more than 35 destinations, plus dining, shopping, Wi-Fi, and two outdoor courtyards at the terminal, just off the 202 Empower Road, justplaineasy.com.
It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm John Hockenberry here in New York. This familiar song in some communities is a sign of the summer. It says ice cream when ice cream trucks pull into the neighborhood. And whether you know it as an ice cream tune or a folk song, former White House fellow and Pentagon cyber warfare expert Theodore Johnson III posted a blog on NPR this week saying the song is also a 1916 racist minstrel song with lyrics about watermelons and African Americans. If you missed the viral blog, it's up on our website. So now we have some work to do with summer right around the corner. Find an alternative song that says, come get your ice cream, without making unappetizing references to America's racial past. Michael Hurst is here to help us out, vocalist and instrumentalist for One Ring Zero. And Michael, I'd like a double scoop of innocent ice cream truck theme with sprinkles. What do you have?
Well, as it happens, I created an entire album of new songs for ice cream trucks, none of which have racist lyrics that I know of yet.
Thankfully, you did this back in 2007. Let's hear some of them.
It's cold and it's sweet, a tasty treat. Ice cream's here to stay. You should come and get some now before I drive away.
Now that's certainly innocent, Michael.
I hope so.
And have you tested it? Do kids come running towards you? What was the mission behind this project?
Well, I was actually in my studio in Brooklyn listening, trying to work and listening to the Mr. Softy truck go by every half an hour and thinking, somebody really needs to write some new songs for this truck. It then occurred to me that somebody was going to have to be me. But the amazing thing is, once this record came out, I started getting contacted by ice cream truck drivers all over the country who were just as sick of the songs they were playing as we, the consumers, were. And so, yeah, the album is being used by at least 50 or 60 trucks around the country that I know of.
And Michael Hurst asking the immortal question, where do ice cream trucks go in the winter? Listen. Now, that's a catchy instrumental. I like that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, when you hear a theremin coming from an ice cream truck, you know I've succeeded.
And let's try a couple other ones here. This one's called Ice Cream Yo. Oh, that's great. It kind of says, this is no drill. The ice cream truck is here.
Yeah, that's your upbeat version.
I like it. So did you go to the ice cream truck when you were little?
I did, but it was a kind of a rare occasion. I grew up in Virginia, and the truck didn't come around very often. And when it did, of course, I was chasing after it with change falling out of my hands and trying to catch it before it drove away.
I know growing up in the suburbs, you know, you'd have to drive chasing the truck in my parents' station wagon. We never had that city experience of pulling up at the street corner, but it's great here in New York.
Well, yeah, and I guess it's a good way to lose weight. If you're running alongside the ice cream truck, you can burn calories while trying to catch up and get your ice cream.
Why do you think the genre of ice cream truck music is important?
Well, I don't know that it is specifically a genre. I like the idea of it being called a genre. But, you know, the idea of having music come from trucks is kind of amazing. I mean, it's something that's new with vehicles coming into play. And for me, it was actually the idea of evoking this sort of innocence and childhood and, you know, something that you just don't hear with a lot of other music. And that was my goal, you know, and the album actually worked very nicely as a children's lullaby album, aside from the whole ice cream truck factor, which is part of the reason I originally worked on it. But it's so awesome that it's being used by ice cream trucks.
Well, Michael Hurst, you've certainly performed a public service for us here.
Well, I hope it continues to spread. Thanks so much for sharing with the rest of the world.
Michael Hurst released a whole album of songs for ice cream trucks back in 2007. He's a vocalist and instrumentalist for the band One Ring Zero. Thanks, Michael.
Thanks, John. I appreciate it.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry.
It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
Come on. We got an old truck. My name is Arturo Castro, and I'm out bull riding at Hogs and Horses in Cave Creek. What they do is you pay your entry fee, and then you draw from a hat what bull you're going to ride for the night. From the moment you get on the bull, you kind of want to step both feet on top of his back to let you know you're there, because otherwise they'll jump in the chute, and they'll jump right out of the chute sometimes. The most dangerous spot is actually in the chute with the bull. Everyone thinks it's the arena, it's actually in the chute, because you're in a confined space with a 2,000-pound animal. That's probably like the biggest rush you get, just sitting on top of them and then feeling them move around underneath you. That's a quick 8-second high.
Arturo Castro, bull riding at Hogs and Horses in Cave Creek. If you have suggestions for future Sounds of the City or, frankly, photos of yourself bull riding, that's great. Send us a note, the show at kjzz.org.
Coming up on the show, we have a chat with Leszek Pawlowicz, a Flagstaff man who's been referred to as the Michael Jordan of game shows.
After you've won, and at the level of these contestants, whether they've won tournaments of champions or college championships or things like that, you no longer have anything to prove. So you can relax and you can enjoy the company of the other people and just go off and try and do the best you can on the actual show.
That's in just a bit on the show.
Pretty easy going so far this afternoon on Valley Freeways. Just one problem spot. It's on the 101 westbound, an accident on the side of the road at 7th Avenue. It's going to be sunny and hot today and right on through the weekend. Look for a high today of 104. 104 again for tomorrow. Cooling down, if you can call it that, on Sunday, all the way down to 102. Right now, under sunny skies in Phoenix, it's 101 degrees at 231.
KJZZ is supported by Central Arizona Museum Association, celebrating International Museum Day, May 18th. Details on how local museums are celebrating at azcama.com.
Summer vacation isn't that far off for many Arizona students, next week in some districts. And while there may be no more teachers for a little while, educators are hoping the old phrase stops there and doesn't continue on to no more books. This week is Children's Book Week, and Linda Radke says things have come a long way since Pat the Bunny and Brody family favorite Goodnight Moon. Radke is president of Chandler Bay's Five Star Publishing, which has a kids division called Little Five Star.
There have been a lot of changes in the industry, and of course, going from the printed book to electronic books to e-files, we do our best to keep up with that. Because it's not just in terms of at bookstores, but at schools and the different electronic tools that are available. So we do our best to make sure that we give a variety of options for teachers, for parents, for students, for kids, and I think that's part of what is changing and trying to keep up with it.
Now, I know that there's some amount of debate out there about the amount of screen time, for example, that kids get. So how do you balance having an actual paper book in front of a kid versus something that maybe they can read on a tablet?
Well, I think the one thing nice about having it available on a tablet is that because children are becoming so addicted to technology, that let's give them something edutaining and educational so that when they are using their tablets, it's being done for an educational purpose. Of course, there's nothing like having a book in your hand or at night with your children and reading a book to them, or a grandparent having a book to read with a child.
Do kids read as much now as they used to?
I hope so. We hope so.
How do you compete with all the other stuff that kids have going on these days? How do you make it cool for them to sit down with a book?
We make it edutaining. And to me, everything is important. Every word is important. The design is important.
We hear all the time about how it's important to get kids reading when they're kids, because otherwise there's a better chance that they won't read growing up as young adults and then as adults. Do you still find that to be the case with all of the information, all of the various things available now that people can read?
You know, I think it's important to give them something to read about that they have an interest in. And because, in other words, if they're just reading about something that's required, but it's not something that relates to their life. I think we're losing them along the way. I'm a former teacher, and there's something magic that happens when you see them light up about something.
Do you find that the same is true for what you've said about younger kids? Is true also about 10, 12 teenagers in terms of what they're reading, how much they're reading, about what they're reading?
Boy, I think that the children today are more sophisticated. Their imagination is far-reaching, and I think it's important to give them something that piques their interest and takes them even one step further along the way because of what they're reading.
So, in your mind, what's the next big thing in children's literature?
Children's writing more books. Books by kids and for kids.
Linda Radke is president of Chandler-based Five Star Publishing.
For a lot of out-of-town visitors, walking into the Desert Botanical Gardens is like entering somewhere unique and unfamiliar. Southwest Shakespeare Company plans to mix a bit of fantasy into that experience with performances of Fairy Worlds, a new and shorter take on A Midsummer Night's Dream.
On the ground, sleep sound. I'll apply to your eye, gentle lover, remedy. Jack shall have Jill, naught shall go ill. The man shall have his mare again.
The story is about this adventures that happen in the woods and these two pairs of lovers that wander into the woods and how the war in the fairy world impacts these four lovers. And it's Shakespeare's idea of love. He tells a story of how insane love is and a sort of a madness that comes over people. But what a great madness it is.
Jared Sacrin is Southwest Shakespeare's artistic director. If his description sounds complicated, he says not to worry. He has trimmed the show down to 85 minutes as he attempts to grow the audience.
When you do a production for true Shakespeare aficionados, you know, they'll get upset when their favorite quotations are not there. This is a production that will be for everybody who loves Shakespeare and for those who hate Shakespeare. It's, I think, going to please both.
How are you going to use the setting?
Well, we have lighting that will feature aspects of the garden behind the stage. It'll come and go as we need it to. We've also got some pretty magical lighting on stage. We have lights that give it a kind of a Cirque du Soleil feel, and that's kind of what we're going for because it's a huge space. We've never really had a stage quite this large. And we've added a lot of very, very special elements to this production.
Well, would you mind telling me a few of those without giving too much away?
Sure. Well, we got a fire breather. We have a tightrope walker. We have some performers in the show with extraordinary physical training. They do dance, gymnastics. Of course, a lot of them are the fairies, but we've really pushed the envelope on what the audience experiences visually with this play.
Southwest Shakespeare usually performs indoors at the Mesa Arts Center. The company used to act outside in the Mesa Amphitheater.
We're in a unique position here in the garden. We're protected by a lot of the garden around us, a lot of land, a lot of acres. You don't have the kind of urban distractions that you would have at the amphitheater. When we did productions at the amphitheater, you could pretty much bet you're going to get sirens. You're going to get police helicopters. We had one night, a police helicopter hovered overhead with a searchlight, looking down for, I swear it had to be in 5 minutes, scanning the stage with the searchlight, like a fugitive from justice was running around in the amphitheater. And we had parties with music cranked up. We've endured so many different things out there. All the nights we've been out here working and putting up the stage, we have not heard that kind of distraction. And I think, even if there are certain things, you know, the weather or whatever, it enhances the experience of being outdoors. I mean, they kind of get swept up in the magic of being outside that you really don't get anywhere else.
When all your performances are done here, what's success?
Well, monetary. We have a budget, and we have to pay for all this. So The ticket sales, of course, will tell us. And then also the enthusiasm of the audiences. I mean, the applause, the response, the laughter, the reaction that we get to what we're doing. And our relationship with the Garden, I think, is going to tell us afterwards when all's said and done if they felt like this was something that they really, A, didn't cause a big headache for them, and they really had a good time doing it and maybe want to do it again.
You'll find Fairy Worlds at Desert Botanical Gardens through June 1st.
Who exactly are the people in your neighborhood, and what do they look like, and what's their story? Those are some of the questions posed by a new photography exhibit that'll be up for one night tonight. It's put together by the Phoenix-based group Culture is Life, a media arts collective for women of color.
We live right here in the neighborhood. We'd walk around the streets and do time lapses or, you know, just like try to do creative things.
Chandra Narcia is one of the photographers on the Faces of Garfield project.
And we'd see all these interesting people that are walking around the neighborhood and wonder, like, I wonder what they do, or, oh, you know, like, just interested in the people around us. And so the project kind of branched out of that interest.
The neighborhood is roughly between 7th and 16th Streets and Van Buren and Moreland. The exhibit shows photos of the people who live there, both those taken by the Women of Culture is Life and those taken and uploaded on Instagram by other residents. Narcia says one of her favorite aspects of the project was how much pride people had in their community.
For the most part, we explained what the project is, and everybody was just so happy to talk about it and proud to take a picture, proud of where they came from.
The three photographers walked around the neighborhood and just asked the people they saw if they would mind having their picture taken. No door knocking involved. Of the more than 100 people they asked to photograph, only a few turned them down.
Well, at first, I was kind of curious to see what they were using it for, what were they planning on doing, which when they told me, I really liked the idea.
Vanessa Ocampo is a third-generation Garfield resident and works in the area. Her photo is one of those that'll be on display tonight.
I think the pictures, it shows how close everybody is and how when you live together and you've been here for years, you help each other and see more each other as family, not just as that's my neighbor. And I think we have lost that contact a little bit, but with this, I think it's going to bring us a lot together. I think it's going to bring in the community together.
Ocampo isn't alone in thinking the exhibit will be good for the neighborhood. Photographer Diana Perez Ramirez says she hopes it'll show the beauty of the community and debunk some perceptions about it, including one she's witnessed.
One particular instance, I was walking into the neighborhood. Some of my colleagues parked their cars in the neighborhood because they'd rather not pay parking. And they asked me if I was going to walk by myself, that I shouldn't do that because it was a dangerous neighborhood, that the people there are dangerous. And I was like, really? Do I look dangerous to you? And I'm like, no, why? Because I'm those people you're scared of.
The three photographers have all lived in Garfield for 2 years or less. They acknowledge they're the newbies. But Perez Ramirez says that's not a problem for the exhibit.
As people who haven't been living here, you know, for a long time, you know, we don't intend to, like, really frame what we're going to be telling as far as the story goes. The way that we did the project was in a way that we just went out and let the neighborhood be and tell the story.
The photos in the exhibit are paired with comments from residents. The third photographer, Barney Kasim, says photos alone couldn't capture what the project was aiming for.
Photography by itself can be objectifying, but we really were intentional about doing more than that by asking questions, taking feedback. So it was more than just photography. It was the intention of including the community in it.
Ann Kasim says she hopes it'll help people look beyond the low income levels in the neighborhood and see its value. Diana Perez Ramirez thinks it could start a conversation.
Art, being a neutral medium, it brings people together and really have a dialogue about what community means. That's one of the things that's refreshing about Garfield. It's like it is still very community-like.
Faces of Garfield will be up tonight from 5 to 9 at Verde Park in Phoenix.
There is a huge variety of good bands in the Valley. One of them joined us in studio. It's Sister Lip, an all-female group that's hard to categorize.
What do you do with those words that you write? Do you copy and paste when you want to?
Hello, we're Sister Lip.
My name is Cassidy, and I play the guitar, and I'm the lead singer.
My name is Emily, and I play bass.
My name's Ariel, and I play drums.
My name's Jenny, and I play piano.
It was hard because we wanted, what we want is an album. We want to make an album, but this is our EP. It's our welcome, it's our hello, and we wanted to give a good range of what we are, like the rock all the way to the like really jazzy, really rock, and like everything in between. So I think it was hard to choose. Like, I lost some of my favorite songs off of it because they sounded too much like the other songs, which would have been great for an album, but not so great for an EP. Around my throat, those
words you wrote are too cold for me. We all have, like, different styles. Like, Ariel, when we met you, you were a little more punky.
Yeah.
It's like that saying, you can't take the, what is it, you can't take the city out of the girl, but you can take the girl out of the city. Like stuff like that, like country, whatever it is. We all kind of have that where like we had a thing before and you can't take us out of that, but we've kind of put ourselves into something new.
We don't want our sound to be the same in every song. So I think that's why we're like, we always like to take our time and be like, let's really think about what we could do to make this song different from our other songs. So as far as like...
But still, like when people hear it, they'll still know it's us, but like it's not... It's not similar, but they'll know.
It's all the same vibe.
Yeah, the same vibe.
Which way to go? Take my hand and we'll go for a ride, you say. 2 weeks and change of the things we can do.
Do people have different expectations, the fact that this is a female band? Do they expect you to sound a certain way? And how often do you dash their hopes?
We dash their hopes very often. This is Jenny, by the way. We get a lot of people thinking we're punk bands just because the all-girl thing happens, I think, in Arizona at least more in the punk scene than it does anywhere else. I think it's shocking when people find out that we're more like on the rock or blues or jazz side, whatever they decide we are at the end of the show. We get almost all of the time when we play in a new place, someone being like, oh, God, I saw you guys and I just didn't expect you to be very good, but you guys are actually really good. Wow. You guys are really good for girls. Like, for girls, you can play.
You really hear that?
Yeah, more often than you'd think.
Now, you guys are not easy to define in terms of what your music is, so how would you define it? How many different words would you use?
We normally say, like, blues, spirit of jazz, like, because a lot of our chord changes are very jazzy, and we do take, like, solos, I scat, and
then you add rock in there so people show up. Look down at my hands full of filth from man after man. No much time it took, a lesson learned, learn on my own.
Let's talk a little bit about your inspirations when we talked about the different types of music you like. A couple of favorite bands from each of you, but that sort of theme.
Jeff Buckley is my man. But I also really listen to anything. Like, I can listen to Black Sabbath and I can listen to Nina Simone. Like, I also sing in a jazz combo at school, so just to like keep that vibe with this band and also like bring in the rock.
This is Emily. I love listening to old-timey music. I love 70s, 60s rock and roll. Zeppelin,
for some of us,
Sabbath.
That's not old-timey, Emily. So.
Before that. Sorry. I love Buddy Miles. I love Etta James. She really gets me. Or I really get her.
My favorite band would be Tegan and Sarah and this dude from New York, Ryan Starr, Crash Kings.
Banana Gun. They're local. And
Say it. We know you want to say it.
Taylor Swift. I'm just going to say it. Jenny?
This is Jenny. I really love Regina Spektor. She was like my first influence. She went to the same college I went to. I played all the pianos just in case she touched them. She's awesome. I love Elton John, Billy Joel. I listen to a lot of piano music, so I mostly am influenced by that. I really like Ben Folds. I've been listening to a lot more jazz lately, especially with this band. It's kind of opened up my mind to a lot of that stuff.
I will walk, there's only one light shining, all the trees blocking out the moon. No more cups of tea at the bottom, your honey, it's not sweet, no, just like a spark.
Do you feel inspired by the local music scene? I mean, is there? Okay, so it's out. Okay.
People give it a bad rap because it's kind of sectioned off. But once you get in it, you almost realize that it just looks that way from the outside. There's a lot of family and a lot of nice stuff going on in there.
There are so many creative people making music in Phoenix, and we are so lucky to be friends with a number of them. And when we were had a residency at Long Wong's in Tempe, a number of bands that we've grown to love played with us there or have started off there or created bands through that place. And it was great for us to meet these fantastic musicians.
One, two, three, four.
That's Sister Lib. The band is releasing its new album, Thanks for the Mondays, tonight and tomorrow at Tempe's Sail Inn. Good afternoon. You're listening to The Show on KJZZ. In news, the growing scandal over deadly delays at the VA hospital in Phoenix has cost a high-ranking official his job. KJZZ's Peter O'Dowd reports.
The top official for Veterans Health Care has resigned. Robert Petzl testified Thursday before the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs. He and his boss, VA Secretary Eric Shinseki, faced tough questions over long waits for appointments, treatment delays, and falsified records at several VA hospitals around the country. This all started in Phoenix when whistleblowers said there was an effort to cover up the deaths of about 40 vets who died while waiting for care. Back in September, Petzl announced his plan to retire in 2014. Peter O'Dowd, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Prescott officials are eliminating the city's remaining elite firefighter positions that were held by Granite Mountain Hotshots, who died in the Yarnell Hill fire last year. The Daily Courier reports the city's proposal would get rid of 6 full-time hotshot crew jobs. The city says it will add 3 fuel technician positions.
KJZZ is supported by ASU's Master of Liberal Studies, welcoming working adults back to the university. No GRE, no thesis, enrolling now. Learn more at asu.edu keywords Master of Liberal Studies. Live to learn. Learn to live.
What if one person, even a close relative or friend, called you the Michael Jordan of anything? Wouldn't that feel great? Well, Leszek Pawlowicz has been labeled the Michael Jordan of game shows by the New York Times. The Flagstaff archaeologist has won on Win Ben Stein's Money, among other programs. His most lucrative experience, though, has been on Jeopardy. He was the victor in one of the program's Tournament of Champions and made the semifinals in this week's Million Dollar Battle of the Decades. We spoke with Leszek earlier today and asked him how it feels to be called the Michael Jordan of game shows.
It's frankly a little bit embarrassing. The name came in a magazine article in the New York Times. And it was basically a hook that the author came up with, which I've never really felt that comfortable with. I mean, I'm pretty good. But I wouldn't put myself Michael Jordan good.
So how did you get good at this? I mean, is this one of those things where you're simply a smart guy who absorbs trivia, or did you have to study? Tell us a little bit more about your background.
Most of what I know I picked up just from reading books and from being alive. If you're looking for some sort of secret that I can give you in terms of how you get all this knowledge and are able to bring it back, you know, at a moment's notice, I don't know. I think some people's brains are just wired naturally to be able to do that. And it's not clear to me that's something you can train. I have done a little bit of studying. There are categories that show up on game shows, in Jeopardy in particular, all the time, like world capitals, state capitals, U.S. presidents, that sort of thing. But beyond that, I found that studying for game shows is a waste of time because the odds of you learning something that's going to show up is minimal.
What's the difference between being on 25-plus years ago, or 25 years or so ago, and coming back for various tournaments of champions? It does seem, just from watching lately myself, it does seem, even though there's $1 million on the line with this latest Battle of the Decades, it seems like all you champions are a little bit having a little bit more fun. Is that true? Once you've won, you can have a little more fun?
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, when you first go on the show, the one thing you want to do more than anything is win one show. So you can say, yes, I've won on Jeopardy. After you've won, and at the level of these contestants where they've won tournaments of champions or college championships or things like that, you no longer have anything to prove. So you can relax and you can enjoy the company of the other people and just go off and try and do the best you can on the actual show. Jeopardy tries to play up the whole competitive, you know, die hard, you know, you're trying to crush your opponents. There wasn't any of that at all, this competition. It was as warm and gracious and friendly a group of people as you'll ever know.
Leslie, I'm going to have our producer, Sarah Ventry, ask you a couple questions. She's not going to try to stump you, but she does want to ask you some, I think these are what? These are Arizona kind of trivia questions.
Yeah, right? There's just a few little Arizona trivia questions and then kind of one curveball at the end. So you ready?
I'm ready.
Great. Okay. What Arizona city is the birthplace of famed labor leader and civil rights activist Cesar Chavez?
Nope, you got me.
It's Yuma, Arizona.
You know, I'm a dope because Yuma was the first city name that popped into my head, and I should have basically gone out, but it's like, okay, yeah, I'd rather say I don't know than get it wrong. So I'll try and avoid that mistake.
Okay, you ready for number two?
I'm ready for number two.
Okay, this one's an audio clue, okay? So you're going to listen to a piece of music, and then you're going to identify which Arizona band you're listening to. You ready?
Sure.
Something will never change.
Man, you're killing me here. You know, I recognize the song. I do not recognize the band.
It's the Meat Puppets.
Yeah, I've heard of the Meat Puppets, but nope.
So the last one is actually not an Arizona question. It actually comes from the winner of this year's Arizona State Geography Bee. He's a sixth grader named Ari Mehta, and this is the question he won this year's Bee.
In the 1500s, Basque settlers settled along the coast of the Strait of Belle Isle in which country?
Okay, could you understand him?
I think he was asking about where Basque settlers settled on Belle Isle in what country?
Should we give him a clue?
You can give him a clue. I'm not giving him a clue.
Okay.
it's
a country very close to Alex Trebek's heart.
Yeah, you know, Now I wish you hadn't told me that because I was going to guess Canada. That's not going to cut it on Jeopardy. I can tell you that right now.
That wouldn't cut it on Jeopardy, but then again, neither would we. Leszek Pawlowicz is an archaeologist and quiz show champ.
The Pioneer.
Have you ever wondered what it was like living in Arizona when it was a territory? There's a North Phoenix village that takes you back in time. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez gives us a tour.
The Pioneer Living History Museum takes us back into the 1800s. The place is best known as Pioneer Village. Did you know many of the buildings here are from territorial times?
Some of these buildings are authentic reproductions and some are originals.
Dave Siebert is the museum's president.
We have the original cabin from the first U.S. Senator from the state of Arizona, Henry Ashurst. We have the Flying V cabin. It was involved in the Pleasant Valley War, and it actually has bullet holes still in it.
Some of the buildings at the 92-acre outdoor museum have been transplanted from around the state. They were built between the 1860s and 1912. There's an original log cabin schoolhouse and teacherage home from Gordon Canyon, a Victorian house that once stood on 7th Street near Indian School Road in Phoenix. And the two-story building by the museum entrance was once rented by the Goldwaters as a general store. It was later converted to Prescott's Opera House. The building was demolished, and the materials were brought here to rebuild it, brick by brick, to look as it did in the late 1800s.
We're an educational nonprofit. We emphasize teaching Arizona history to Arizona school children. That's our mission.
Several of the buildings are reproductions, like the Gila County Sheriff's Adobe Jail. And then there's the community church. It's a copy of the St. Paul's Methodist Episcopal Church that stood in Globe from the 1880s until 1927.
The church would have been real, but they couldn't move it because the wood was all rotted. So they had to reproduce it. But when you get south of the church, everything is real. You know, you're seeing a tremendous amount of real history.
There's one other building with an interesting story. The structural shell of the Phoenix Bakery is here and ready for restoration. Once near Central Avenue and Washington Street, it was the first business in Arizona to introduce the horse-drawn delivery wagon. The building ultimately became the home of Wholesome Bakery. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
Lots of good stuff going on around the Valley this weekend. You can see the D-backs host division rival L.A. Dodgers this weekend at Chase Field. Also, the Mercury open their season tomorrow night against the Seattle Storm at U.S. Airways Center.
And as you heard earlier in the show, you can also see Fairy Worlds at Desert Botanical Gardens performed by Southwest Shakespeare Company.
The show was produced this week by Sarah Ventry and Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez, with help from Tiara Vian, Bruce Drummond, Alexandra Olgan, and Kendra Sabo. Tracy Greer is our digital media editor. Our managing editor is Al Macias. Our news director is Peter O'Dowd, and our executive producer is John Hoban.
For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks very much for listening to the show on listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. And try to stay cool this weekend. It'll be difficult. Might want
Tough
to stay
job.
Inside or get up really, really early in the morning. All things considered is next. Have a great weekend. It's 3 o'clock.